Hello, and welcome to the Inside Aviews podcast for February the 17th, 2023. This is episode number 150. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we'll be talking with Corey Steuben, president of Munroe & Associates, and discussing the debut of the Ram 1500 REV pickup and Ford's $3.5 billion LFP battery factory for Michigan, and much more. I'm Dominic Ioni, Inside EV's forum moderator and Inside EV's editor. Joining us today is the inimitable Mr. Tom Malogny, senior editor at Inside EV's and host of the YouTube channel State of Charge. We also have the majestic Mr. Martin Lee from EV News Daily Podcast, which is available on all the best podcast platforms. And of course, Kyle Connor joins us from the majestic, practically palatial halls of Autospec Studios, where he produces high voltage videos for a growing number of YouTube channels. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
How are y'all doing today, this morning?
Good. Hey, good.
All right. So, Corey, I'm glad you could join us this morning, and I hope you don't mind us picking your brain a bit. As I mentioned, you are the president of Munroe & Associates. So, in my mind, Munroe & Associates is at least a teardown company. Like, you take cars and tear them down as far as possible, price out all the parts and the processes for building cars, and then publish or compile a report and then sell that. But over the last few years, I think you also do some consulting, lean manufacturing, and probably a number of other things. But a few years ago, Sandy Munroe, who's the founder of the company, began making videos and posting them on YouTube of electric vehicle teardowns with a heavy emphasis on Tesla, and discovered there's like a huge audience for this kind of content. Mm-hmm. So fast forward today, and now the Munroe Live YouTube channel puts out a steady stream of videos, some with Sandy, but now some with also other features, other members of the Munroe team, including yourself. So I'm curious, and I hope others are too, how has this like really changed the company? I can imagine the revenue from the YouTube is, you know, helps pay for some of the production, but you know, I feel like it's completely altered your business, like raising its profile and introducing new customers and things.
Yeah, I can go into the benefit that it's had. It's essentially doubled our revenue. So wow. Munroe was a 60 to 80 person engineering firm for the better part of the last decade. But essentially, since the YouTube channel came out, our sales lead stream is incredible. We get hundreds of emails a week from companies that we would have never reached because they watch our YouTube videos. So we'll get emails from people in Europe like, hey, I want a report on the Model Y thermal system. And it's just had an incredible impact. When we went to CES, we had a booth, and about 70% of the people that came to our booth opened with, we love your videos. So we knew there'd be a risk because in our videos, we give away a lot of content. So we'll spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars a year buying these vehicles and tearing them down. It's no small feat because we destroy the vehicles. Right. And some of our competitors kind of cringe because mm-hmm. we're showing what the battery looks like. When we got that 4680 Tesla Model Y, we're peeling the battery lid off, essentially giving away a lot of the high-level benchmarking insights. But where we really thrive is when we create our reports and sell the cost analysis and the assembly analysis and whatnot. But what's been the best part about the YouTube journey is meeting people like Kyle and Tom out on the road. It's a nice little fraternity of EV space creators. And now we have a small team. We have a team of three led by Eric. We have a videographer, Grace, and a graphic designer, Aaron, that churn out. I think we had 550 discrete pieces of content last year, if you count YouTube Shorts, Instagram, all the other platforms. So I'm really happy with the impact it's made to our team. And we hope it continues to grow and kind of be fruitful coming forward. And like, I'm headed to Texas. So we're headed to Texas for the Tesla Investor Day. We're not going to the event. Are any of you guys going to be there? Kyle, are you going to be there?
That's March 1st, right?
March 1st, yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what Elon has to say for his, what is it? It's his master plan part 3. Hopefully it gives a little more detail on the scale of what his plans are. That's what we derived. I remember if you guys saw that image that was posted on the invite.
Yes.
It was little body side outers. And I was able to decode that pretty quickly, and I put that up on Twitter. And I don't know. So do you have any specific questions or any directions you want to go?
Before we jump into that, Corey, one thing I want to mention, my first exposure to you guys was back in 2016 or 2017, and Pete Glass brought it up in the comment section. I was a BMW i3 owner, and I was fascinated with how BMW engineered that vehicle. It's mm-hmm. It doesn't get the credit it should, in my opinion. You know, they started with such a I know the clean sheet of paper is an overused term, but BMW really did. That vehicle is so unlike anything else ever made, you know, with the CFRP frame and just all the fasteners they use and the things, the way they glued the body together. And I was privy to that information as it was being engineered because I was kind of involved in BMW's electric vehicle program. And I was like writing and blogging about and saying, this car is fantastic. And everybody was just looking at it and saying, yeah, but it's butt ugly. Who cares how fantastic it is? You know, look, you know, engineering. But then you guys did that teardown and like Sandy was just like drooling over it. Mm-hmm. He was like, this is amazing what BMW has done. And then what you guys did was what was amazing. You sold your teardown report for like $50.
$10.
Yeah. That's crazy. You sell that for like millions usually. And I wrote a post on Inside EVs and I wrote on my box. I said, everybody who cares anything about cars, spend the $10 and buy this damn thing because you're getting like $1 million report for $10.
You truly are. It's, I think, 26,000 pages. If you can buy it right now on MonroeLive.com for $10. And the reason why we sell it for $10 is because we initially tried to sell it for over $1 million. And for the first 3 or 4 years, we had some takers who would buy big chunks of the reports, typically OEMs or suppliers. But we went too far. We did a full detail costing. So if you understand cost analysis, there's detailed costing, which is excruciating. You're essentially going from raw material to finished product without using assumptions. And there's a higher level called quick costing or directional costing where you cut out about 75% of the work, but then you get about 85% the accuracy. We now do more of a directional costing when we do our teardowns, but we spent over $2.5 million worth of man hours creating that. And we created in 2016, I think, 15, 16. But by the time it got to 2020, it was the pandemic. We hadn't sold any of the BMW i3 report in a year and a half. So I just suggested to Sandy, as a loss leader, I said, we should sell it for $10 on MonroeLive.com. And he's like, that's crazy. And a lot of people didn't like it. I think I've sold well over $120,000 worth, $10 at a time. Everybody in the world has it. And when you buy it, you just download all the 10 PDFs and it's like a gig worth of data, and people are blown away. But the data ages. So that was costed in 2015 and 16. The material costs have all changed. The processing has changed. So the reports actually lose value if they're not updated. But if you ever want to see how everything in that car is made, it's only $10.
Yeah, which is crazy. And it was such a great deal back then. And I haven't looked at it in a while. I still have it downloaded. But I just remember like being an i3 geek, and so is Kyle. Like, it was just amazing for $10.
Yeah.
And I forget. I thought it was $50. At $50, it would have been a ridiculously good deal. $10, geez, that's nuts.
And I have a question for Kyle. So the styling for the i3 when it came out, I thought it was kind of – you know, people didn't like it at first. I think it's kind of come into its own. We have someone at Monroe who drives one, and when they pull up to work now, I think it looks better now than it did when it came out. What do you think about that?
I had the exact conversation yesterday, the exact conversation where I was walking, because we did a Waymo ride yesterday and we had to walk to get into the service area, and an i3S blacked out, the nice wide fenders rolled by. And, you know, I've owned three i3s. I never thought they looked amazing. And then this thing rolls down the road. I'm like, holy crap, that looks awesome. And especially from the back, the way that thing sits. So i3 100% is aging really well.
Yeah.
And no one could have predicted it back in period.
It was the car ahead of its time, period. I mean, it's, you know, I know, again, that's another term that gets overused, but it really was. I mean, if not for its super short range, like, you know, BMW could have stuffed more batteries into that car. They could have used the better next generation. They could have launched with the 22 kilowatt hour battery pack. But Samsung SDI was basically telling them the next generation, the battery pack that was, I think, 33 kilowatt hour, that could have been ready for them at launch. And BMW was like, nope, it hasn't undergone enough long testing, and we're not comfortable with it yet. We're going to launch with the 22 kilowatt. We'll bring that one out in 2 years. And I got that information directly from a high-level BMW manager who was lobbying for them to launch with the larger battery, which would have given it over 100 miles of driving range back in 2014, and it would have been on par with a premium vehicle because BMW is a premium brand. Anyway, we're going off the rails too much. Corey's only here for a little bit, and we want to hear what he has to say.
Can I get into Tesla? Is that okay?
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm always really interested about is when you read these things, you know, Tesla is 8 years ahead of the competition. Tesla is 10 years ahead of the competition. Well, in the world we live in now, anything made today can be copied instantly tomorrow. I'm not saying it's easy to do that. Otherwise, I think all the other OEMs would have the software team that Tesla have. But let's be simplistic. Anything made today can be copied tomorrow. So where do you stand on that kind of shorthand cliche that Tesla is X years ahead of the competition? Because they clearly are better at so many things. Herbert Diess at VW openly said they do it better, and he's no longer leading that company. So it seems that if you're one of the older, established guard, and you maybe throw some love towards other ways of doing it, that's not necessarily going down too well with some people. What are your thoughts on this whole, they've got this unassailable lead, and as long as they keep innovating, they'll never be caught?
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, I would agree that they were 7 years ahead of the competition. But you have many OEMs scrambling to develop platforms and EVs that show the same level of elegance and integration, whether that's body structure with large castings, thermal systems that are more like the super manifold, super bottle, or octovalve, software and EV architecture, particularly with the number of modules. I think when we tore down our Model Y, it had half the amount of modules, electric modules than the Mach-E. And their advantage when it comes to software, particularly with FSD, that's like the one that's the hardest to pin down because software is very hard to benchmark. And so I think their lead is eroding. So what's really important is what Elon's going to announce on March 1st. Will this be another step change? Because you see companies like Hyundai and Kia come out with an 800 volt system, which has some advantages over a 400 volt system. You see the battery technology was kind of stagnated until they launched with the 4680. We're not necessarily seeing the advantages in the 4680 that Elon stated at Battery Day back in 2021. We're seeing about half to maybe three quarters of the quoted advantage. The structural battery pack is like amazingly novel, but we did a really in-depth study comparing and contrasting that to the previous Model Y, and it's not as big of an advantage as we thought. But the one thing that people aren't recognizing is how much of an advantage Tesla has in their ability to manufacture the vehicles quickly. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a great period where OEMs outsourced large subassemblies. So this is before EVs. They would outsource whole front-end modules, instrument panels, seats, headliners, to drop the engineering hours per vehicle in the assembly plant, because OEMs were kind of judged on how quickly they could manufacture cars, and there was really a volume war. Tesla is insourcing, integrating so much of their own stuff, but they're still thinking with that same high volume mentality. So there's also a lack of complexity. So Honda used to lead the US in particular with the lack of complexity for the Civic and for some of their high runners. They would build just silver Civics for like weeks, and they only had three trim levels. And if you ever tried to order a Honda, it wasn't very customizable compared to a Chrysler product, where they had literally a million variants of Cherokee that you could order based on the off-road packages and colors and all sorts of stuff. The reason why that's a huge advantage is when they're building these greenfield factories like Giga Texas, Giga Shanghai, and Giga Berlin, they can set up a dreadnought facility. They can pump these things out because they only have two wire harnesses for the Model Y and the Model 3. They don't have 10 variants of wire harnesses for low voltage because when you order every Tesla, it gets hardware 3 or hardware 4. They're not trying to squeeze the purchasing pennies out by not including the hardware and having a different harness. And there's not a low-end version with no cameras. And all the other OEMs, what they do is the purchasing department will try and squeeze out all the dollars and cents and pennies they can of the low trim. But what they do is they add a huge amount of complexity into the manufacturing process for line-side kitting and all sorts of crazy complexity when you're building the vehicle. I remember I once did a study for an OEM in Detroit just on wheel liners because they had 14 different wheel liners at a plant, 14 left front wheel liners because they had four different engines and each engine had a different like air scoop. They had a performance version. They had a non-performance version. They had an all-wheel drive version. And this was a sedan.
Man.
14 different wheel liners. They paid us like $100,000 to study the wheel liners. So think of all the money that is wasted by large OEMs. I didn't mind taking the money to study wheel liners.
Right.
We ended up getting it down from 14 to 7, and it was a huge savings.
And they probably thought that was the biggest innovation ever. Like, so you work with a lot of established companies, established OEMs, right? So, and obviously you work with them, so you know they are your customers, and you have to be careful what you say. So I'm not asking for specific names, just to be clear. But how does that feedback go down with them? So when you say this new, because Tesla isn't a startup, but when you say this new startup company with different ways of working and a wild CEO is showing you guys how to do it, is that do they nod and smile and then go away and do what they want? Are they genuinely listening? Is there friction? What's that process like when you say you've been doing it 100 years and you're doing it wrong?
So that is one of the best questions I've received in the past 2 years, because I'm going to go back to what Sandy says. It's 90% psychology and 10% technology. So in order to win over the minds, the hearts and minds of any of our clients, we have to make them think it's their idea. Because we have competitors in the engineering space that will ram an idea down someone's throat. They'll say, I am a high level person. I know what I know, and you should do this. You know what they do? Just like you said, they walk away and said, nah, I'm not going to do that. So I'll give you one example of something non-EV related. Back in 2015, I was working on a development program of a minivan. And the way that the shock mounted in the rear used existing tooling in the plant. And the existing tooling was a KUKA pallet that had vertical screw guns. And they were developing a new vehicle that had $3.50 worth of structure and aluminum to account for the old tooling. And when I did a little trade-off study that if they emulated Ford and Honda with it's like a little bar with bolts from the side. So it changed the manufacturing process. It would save $7 a vehicle and like 4 pounds. Now, $7 a vehicle on a vehicle that they make $200,000 a year for 7 years, and actually it might be in existence for a decade. You're talking, you know, monumental savings. I had to essentially do a careful campaign where I convinced a body engineer that it was his idea. Because if I just would have went and say, you need to do this, and I was like 26 at the time. And it was one of my proudest achievements is that when that minivan rolls down the road, I know that that rear shock screws in from the side. Now, our company fights these battles times a million when it comes to EV architecture, how the battery cases are developed. And we arm ourselves with benchmarking data. So the main purpose of us doing all these teardowns is because we can give more context and more defense to our ideas. So that was a great question. And some OEMs are more receptive than others. Typically, the more downtrodden OEMs, the ones who are further behind, are more willing to change. Some of the larger organizations that say that they're leading the world in the EV resolution, they don't even want to talk. So it's kind of interesting to see how different customers of ours react, but we spend all of our time trying to very carefully convince people that they should move in a certain direction, and it's challenging.
So do you see any particular electric vehicle technologies, like maybe especially in batteries or the manufacturing of the vehicle themselves, any like trends that this, maybe some of the laggards need to jump onto?
Yeah, so I'd say volumetric and gravimetric density from a battery pack perspective is something that we're pushing. So look at the volumetric density of a 4680 pack. Okay. All the cells are packed together. They use the pink foam. You have a high level of density. You're eliminating all the wasted air gap space. So look at the BMW i3 pack. We were talking about that earlier. When you take the lid off, there's like an inch and a half or almost an inch between all of the, I think there's 8 modules in there. And there's all these air gaps. Plus then there's aluminum plates and everything is bolted and screwed. Then they have low voltage harnesses connecting all the BMS. It's incredibly inefficient from a volumetric perspective. Right. You don't want to be carrying air in the battery pack. You want to get volumetric and gravimetric density. So the BYD blade, I think, is really important. You know, that's really highly dense. So once you can get all the air out of the pack, that's the first step. Once you can streamline your battery management system, that's really important. And then when it comes to inverter technology, I think that you maybe in the next 5 to 10 years, you'll see switch from silicon to silicon carbide. We've already seen that switch. Mm-hmm. And then maybe the use of gallium nitride. You know, there's other technologies. And then another thing that's really important is traditional OEMs typically develop multiple internal combustion engine platforms to support their portfolio. So right. You'd have a General Motors would have a small inline four, then they'd have a high feature inline four. They'd have a naturally aspirated V6, high feature twin turbo V6. Then they have a naturally aspirated V8. Then they have like a high performance V8. So when you have this wide array of powertrains, that can now be solved with one motor solution. So look at Tesla. Model S Plaid uses the same stator as the Model 3 rear-wheel drive. You know, so you have the lowest performing Model 3 and the highest performing Model S is using the same technology in the powertrain. They changed the rotor with the carbon fiber wrapping. Right. So I think that you see a less of a reliance on powertrain development, and that's some kind of a paradigm shift. So
nice. In general, you like what like companies like Volkswagen and GM are doing for scale, as far as like building up a platform with a lot of commonalities over the whole range, or
well,
no, it's not quite that simple.
Yeah, I've been critical of the Ultium platform, okay. Particularly because what GM showed was I think like a dozen different variants of the powertrain, and also when they showed pictures of the stators, they were still threaded fastener bolted stators. So most stators had gone to press in. And when you do press in stators, it's better for thermal, it's better for packaging. So when I noticed that they still had the, if you see the photo, there's lobes sure. with long bolts that go through, they were touting this and they still had a high level of complexity. And then they still had in kind of an archaic way of mounting the stators, and then they had multiple different gearbox configurations. So they were touting the scale, but I still looked relatively complex when they showed their portfolio of motor gearbox right. and inverter strategy. I wasn't that impressed because okay. we're always comparing back to Tesla.
Right.
Tesla uses the exact same low voltage oil pump to circulate the gear oil on the Plaid that it does the Model 3. And from what we can indicate, the tough part is, where are the products from GM? I was at the Chicago Auto Show talking to the person with the Silverado EV And I said, hey, when am I going to get my Silverado EV? He goes, well, you know, they're all sold out. I'm like, I ordered one on the first day. Where is it? And he had no answer.
And, right. I mean, they're pretty much on schedule with the Silverado, aren't they, though? As far as their stated timeline of
yeah.
But there it is true. There is kind of something going on. I think at GM with production, I'm not really sure. Like the Cadillac Lyric, they've built like 200 of them last year or something. By the end, is that the right number? I don't know if anyone can fact check.
I think they delivered 122. I think I read that,
which is like a lot lower than I expected, right?
They are starting to deliver now. I've had multiple followers tell me that they got their Lyric this week and that they're showing up at dealerships. So okay. I think right now they're starting to get out there.
Kyle, have you ridden in one? Have you driven one?
It is the one new EV I have zero experience with up to this point.
Did you, Corey?
I rode in one at the Chicago Auto Show, and I live in Michigan. I see them all over the place.
Okay.
And I had the opportunity to drive one at an event called the Greenbrier, which is this leadership conference in the hills of West Virginia. They had one there, right. But it was completely booked. And it was mysteriously, I couldn't get a ride. I could have driven that by myself and I could have done a rogue filming, but you're not supposed to bring media to this private, this private meeting in the hills of West Virginia. So I would have like broken the code. So I didn't want to get kicked out after my first year.
Right. Well, what kind of impression did you get from just riding it?
The interior is nice. It reminded me of an Escalade interior, a nice OLED screen. The user interface is, I think, pretty well refined. I drive a GM product. I drive a Yukon, and I love my infotainment, the quality of the screen, the responsiveness. I get over-the-air updates, and things change and get updated. So, I mean, it's like a CUV. You know, it's like a hatch car, and I have three kids and a dog. It wouldn't work for me. I'd rather have a Model Y.
So. Right. Someone mentioned Cybertruck here in the comments. So that's one of the big products that a lot of people are looking forward to seeing. And I'm not sure if anyone's really, I mean, maybe you have actually, you guys probably did in your videos on Monroe Live, but just talked about, you know, the structural advantages of the shape of that thing and what they're doing there exactly.
Well, I think it actually introduces more problems than it does advantages, because the way that body side outers are stamped and formed is really well established. It's very thin Class A material, and now you're going to a very thick, essentially most likely broke bent, you know, where you're bending it. It gets complicated because it's strong material, it's thick and it's stiff, and you're probably bonding to a dissimilar material. So that's what people don't realize, is the Cybertruck is going to be a mixed material vehicle. There's no way the whole thing's going to be stainless steel. It'd be astronomically expensive.
Right.
So the underbody is most likely going to be a mix of mild steels, ultra high strength steels for the A pillar and the B pillar. You'll have aluminum throughout. And a lot of OEMs really mastered the mixed material strategy, particularly Audi with their D3 platform, which they launched in the mid to late 90s. And then the D4 platform slowly started to introduce more steel back into the vehicle to pass a lot of the crash tests for IIHS, particularly oblique pole, small overlap, rigid barrier, and roof crush. So vehicles that were pure aluminum in the 90s now are more mixed material to pass a lot of these stringent tests. So I think the Cybertruck will be a very mixed material vehicle. And that poses a ton of challenges. The early Model 3 that we got, the huge amount of complexity in the rear end, it was a mixed material body. It was a lot of steel and a lot of aluminum combined with ultra high strength adhesives, Henrobs, SPRs, self-piercing rivets. It's just a wide array of complexity. And then you introduce a lot of different robots and machines and quality controls into the plant. So I think there was a comment that the Cybertruck was difficult to build. I don't remember. I think I read it on Twitter. Elon maybe said something that it's been difficult. It won't be easy.
Right. Yeah. But I think it's, Right. I was just going to say, I think the design of it has just driven a lot of interest in the company and in the product. And, mm-hmm. but, you know, they have a huge number of pre-orders for that thing. And I'm not sure if they did it like a traditional vehicle or traditional pickup design, if it would have had that same kind of impact.
My opinion on the Cybertruck is I think it'll do phenomenally well. They'll sell it for years and years and years. It'll be a crowd stopper when you drive through a town. I know we're going to get one as fast as we can, even if we have to pay double for it. So I'm going to be able to bebop around town and everyone's going to look at it, and then we're going to tear it down. We're going to get millions of views, whatever. But the game over move for Tesla is if they just launched a three-row SUV, like a real SUV,
like a traditional
Telluride. If they just had a Telluride that was electrified, and instead of being Telluride, it was Teslaride or whatever.
That'd be a pretty funny name.
Everybody would buy it. They're selling. Yeah. They're kicking ass in a market that's dying. Cars and CUVs. Other OEMs have given up on cars. Mm-hmm. It's like, what are they doing? And I get it, because when you're looking at an EV and you want to minimize your usage of batteries, you want your most efficient vehicle possible, which is a CDA sedan, small coefficient of drag, mm-hmm. because then you can get 300 miles of range with 68 kilowatt hours of a battery.
Yeah.
And if you do it poorly, then you have 100 kilowatt hours of battery and you have 200 miles of range, like some of the first EVs we saw. And if you have an SUV, you need an even bigger battery, then the value proposition drops. So the game over checkmate move is if they enter that soccer mom market, the Grand Cherokee, the Explorer, even the Cherokee, the Kia Sportage, the Nissan Rogue, make it look like an SUV. Yes, the MPGe will go down, but give it 230 miles of range with a 100 kilowatt hour battery, and it'll be game over. Like, oh my gosh. So I know. Yeah. Kyle, what do you think on that? I think we align on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think Tahoe size minimum. We need big electric vehicles. Look at Rivian R1S. Awesome vehicle. We had it. You had the same one, Corey.
Yeah.
And the only thing we just kept wishing was build it on the R1T chassis and make it longer. There's not enough room in there. We did a whole review where we had a family come in, bring their two or three kids, child seats in the back, and we're like, okay, that's now full, and then there's no room for your luggage. So big electric SUVs are what everyone needs. That's the market right now.
Mm-hmm. So that's like what Kia is doing with the EV9 and something like that size, basically.
Yeah, but we're not totally sure if that's going to be Telluride size or slightly smaller or bigger yet. It's still just a concept, so we'll have to see. But I think they're onto something with their concept.
Right. I mean, it has a huge wheelbase. Hyundai's doing that huge pushing the wheels up to the ends, big wheelbase,
Well,
a lot of interior cabin space.
Ioniq 5 has a longer wheelbase than Telluride and Palisade already.
Right,
it's the longest wheelbase in the lineup. So not unlike other stuff that they're doing.
Can I, before we lose Corey, can I take it to the other end of the scale and talk cheap EVs? I mean, I don't know what your first car was. Mine was something called a Fiat Uno, if you even had that in the US. But it was, or maybe my first car was a Fiat Panda. It wasn't mine. It was mum's, but it was left over. My first car was a Fiat Uno. Either way, it would have been £200 or £300 to buy that, and if I wrecked it as a 17-year-old when I first got my license, it wouldn't have been the end of the world. EVs are a lot of money, and we're very fortunate, all of us on this podcast, right? None of us particularly spring chickens are, buying our first car, and we've got some nice cars in our driveways, right? So people who are getting their first car, even people on a lower income who need transport to get to work, to run their errands, to get their family to the places they're going to go, EVs are too expensive. Used EVs are too expensive. You're never going to get an EV that's 10 years old that's going to be like your $400 beta. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on cost? And I know it's sort of a little bit sticking your finger in the air here and asking you to predict the future, which is hard, but when can you see costs coming down that eventually feeds through to second, third, fourth hand cars where EVs become a bit more affordable to people, and what technologies could do that?
Yeah. So this is a great question. First, I want to cover the economics of it. So sometimes people forget about inflation. So $25,000 now is, I think, the equivalent of like $15,000 20 years ago. So when people say they want that $25,000 car, what they're really saying is they want a $15,000 vehicle from that long ago. So I think when people arbitrarily say $20,000 or $25,000, it kind of makes me cringe. I want to talk about affordability based on what people make, because I know what we pay our engineers, and it's like double what we paid our engineers as recently as 2009. So there's the affordability aspect of it. And then there's the functional objectives of what people expect from a vehicle. So if you bought, my first vehicle was a 1991 Nissan Maxima that I bought in 2001. It was red, sport edition. I loved it. I kept it for like 13 years. I it had 250,000 miles on it. I would drive it now today if it was safe. But here's the thing. That vehicle had no airbags, no anti-lock brakes. It was like a big go-kart, because it did not have ultra high strength steel in the A or B pillar. If I would have gotten an accident, that thing, it would have folded up like a pretzel. I loved it. It only weighed like 2,800 pounds because there was nothing in it. It was a mild steel body with a V6 engine with 185 horsepower and a manual transmission. It was amazing. I loved it. Now, you buy a vehicle today, you're carrying the burden of all the safety equipment. Now, I know this is an EV channel. We're talking about EV.
Oh, that's good.
You are carrying thousands of dollars worth of ultra high strength steel that is required to protect occupants in a lot of these stringent tests. Even some of the SUVs now have to pass a federal motor vehicle safety standard called FMVSS 226 ejection mitigation. What that means is your airbags have to deploy below the belt line and retain unbelted occupants as you roll off the freeway. Because NHTSA realized, or the federal FMVSS, they realized that a lot of people are being killed because SUVs are so prevalent that rollovers became more common and passengers being ejected became more common. So all vehicles carry these high burden of safety measures that didn't exist back in used cars. So there's the safety measures. And now you add electrification and ADAS. So what is an EV? An EV is an electric vehicle. You have an electric motor, you have a battery, you charge it. Just having a cheap electric vehicle is one thing, but now people expect it also to have a lot of safety features like lane keep assist and automatic braking and forward vision collision alert and Blue Cruise and Super Cruise and all the, depending on whatever the OEM is, that adds thousands of dollars per vehicle. And if you look at just the hardware costs, it's astronomical. The software costs and development costs are even higher. So you have to define what is the bare minimum expectation. And if you say you need someone to have an EV that's in a city that has 150 miles of range and doesn't have all the ADAS capability, and heck, doesn't have the safety requirements. Like in Japan, there's those little cars. I forget what they're called.
K cars.
Yeah.
Okay.
An electrified K car, that'll be cheap.
Yeah.
But if people want the vehicle to do everything, I want to be able to drive it from Michigan to California. I want to be able to set the cruise at 80 miles an hour. I want air conditioning that cools. I want dual zone. I want a big screen. I want people can't have everything. And we, Monroe, we are paid to analyze every cent of every dollar that's spent everywhere in the car. And vehicles today are not vehicles of the past. So many baby boomers, Gen X, and millennials like me, I paid $3,500 for my 10-year-old car back in 2001. Now, and it only had 80,000 miles on it. Now a vehicle with 80,000 miles is what? 12 grand, 10 grand, if it's nice.
Yeah.
And the vehicles have more in them. They offer more. The functional objectives bring more value to the customers. So oftentimes I answer this question like, we need to reset what our expectations are before we apply backwards economics on affordability.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I think it's really a complicated question. And
And it's something that people don't do any deep thinking of. They're just like, well, I paid $400 for my first car, so you know, why can't we get cheap cars anymore? But hey, yeah. Look, I know we're gonna lose you before too long because you've got a business to run. But I want to say thank you for coming on. And And what I find really impressive about what you all do is your channel really is a lot of knowledge coming together from people on your team. And it would be so easy, I think, for Sandy Monroe. I've never met Sandy, but you know, as an absolute rock star, it's his name above the door. He could just be the face of the channel, mm-hmm. and then one day he might want to, I don't know, retire. I can't see him retiring, and then do that difficult handover process. But very quickly with Monroe, you were, I don't know whether you were a reluctant participant or not, but they got you on the camera to host, and all the other engineers as well. It feels like an ensemble cast, and obviously, if there's an Elon interview, Sandy's going to do that. But I really feel like I'm getting an insight into a wider team. And it would be easy just to put Sandy in front of the camera, and he's the star. And so thank you for that. I think I learn a lot from what you put out for free. I just want to say thank you.
Yeah, no problem. It's the least we could do. And we're gonna bring a lot more this year. We're trying to pick our another teardown to do. We're thinking about doing maybe an Ioniq 5 or Ioniq 6, EV6, something from Kia or Hyundai, because it's what gets requested right below the Cybertruck. People want to see that. So
EGMP platform, yeah, that's a big one for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good technology. It's on the 800-volt platform, mm-hmm. like you said, but the problem with it, I think I find, where they don't compete with Tesla, is they don't have the scale. You know, they're not building... I mean, Tesla really has everybody, like you mentioned, on scale, and just continuing to push that advantage, you know, with a more expansion of the gigafactories and mm-hmm. and now lithium processing. Yeah, it's just kind of crazy. Before you go, I would like to, if we could, I don't know if you have, but just want to make sure you have time, just to touch on a couple of news items real quick. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
All right. So I think the big product news of the week this week has to be the surprise debut of the Ram 1500 REV pickup during the Super Bowl. And we just saw the concept version of this a few weeks ago, and now, boom, this. So basically, there's no details available about the truck yet, really, but I think it should arrive on the market around 2024. Ram is ready to take your money, though. You can give them $100 for access to pre-order and possibly get like exclusive invitations mm-hmm. to events like or experiences like first drives and first looks. So, Corey, did you see this during the Super Bowl?
Yeah.
What are your takeaways about the difference between like this and the concept? We talk about concepts a little bit here, and sure. we don't like talking about them too much because things change so much. But I don't know, what's your takeaway on this, or what's your perspective?
So what I saw at CES, when I was there, I saw the concept. It was just that. You never end up seeing... And this is the actual
production version.
That's the REV. This is what I thought it would look like, you know, when you actually come to production, because right. they're not gonna redesign the cab. So the cab is the same. They do a front facelift. They change the lift gate with new taillights, and REV. So what does REV mean? Define right. it. Range extended vehicle.
Right.
So I don't know if they've announced it yet, but I think it'll have a range extender in it.
Yeah, so, I think no question at this point. You know, they even mentioned it in their silly yeah. Super Bowl ad, which half the people loved, half the people hated. But it's all about, you know, EVs today don't work. Why don't you wait for our solution? And we're finding ways to extend the range. We know that they want to do a range extender, which right. is actually a great application for, you know, sort of pickup truck usage or van usage.
Yeah.
Having a little range extender.
Yeah, imagine if you have this at a workstation, and let's say they put their inline four, heck, the Pentastar in there for a generator. Now you have an actual generator at your work site. So not only do you have an electric vehicle that could have maybe 80 or 100 kilowatt hours of range, so you suffer a little bit on battery size, but now you have a generator that you can run all day to run your job site. Instead of having, you know, Pro Power on board, you're still draining the battery. Now you're not draining the battery. Depending on how big the fuel tank is for a range extender, I think it makes a lot of sense for the next 3 to 5 years until battery technology has a step change improvement. But really, that heavy duty industry, EVs don't make sense for heavy duty. Like once you go to 2500, 3500, class 8, class 6, diesel is such an efficient way to store energy and move freight. Then unless you, I don't want to go down the hydrogen rat hole, but that's a different story. But just batteries get too heavy and too expensive to right. make sense.
Right. Do you guys look at batteries over there at Monroe, like emerging chemistries or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, really? So we have a couple partners where we send out all of our cells to get tested. So we have, you know, a Rivian that got tore down, sent the cells out. The 4680 cells, sent the cells out. 2170s, 18650s. We do a chemical analysis. We do CT scans. We sell that. We sell that data.
Right.
It's pretty common.
But do you get access to upcoming technology, like say like a solid state cells, like people are developing? Do you get any peeks at that?
Yeah, we went out to San Jose and interviewed the CEO of QuantumScape, Jagdeep Singh. Back, we got a whole tour of their factory.
Yes,
and then we're headed out to California. I think Sandy found some new 3D printed solid state battery. We're going to go tour that. So all of our early access is predicated on us with the Monroe Live stuff. You know, people want to brag about their things, but not from a commercial perspective. We do work with battery suppliers. I do have to say that. We had one in this week doing a workshop, a cost reduction workshop.
Okay.
You know, I'd be really interested in seeing you guys do, Corey, is doing a teardown on one of the new, say, Chinese startups like NIO or XPeng or Li Motors or BYD. I think that would be interesting to see because a lot of people are concerned with quality with Chinese vehicles. Historically, they haven't made good vehicles. It's part of the reason why we really haven't had a global Chinese brand, you know, that was sold all over the world. But now with the EVs, they seem to be gaining ground on traditional, legacy brands and making what appear to be high quality vehicles. And I, for one, would be really interested to see you do a teardown of one of these brands to see, are they prime time or are they still a decade behind in manufacturing and safety and, you know, how well the vehicle's built? So
spending time in Norway and Sweden last year, I was able to see a lot of Chinese EVs because they're penetrating the European market a little earlier. Mm-hmm. We saw XPeng or XPeng, however you pronounce it, NIO, a few other ones. And their interior quality, their build quality is good. Their manufacturing methodology slightly delayed when it comes to body construction, still heavily reliant on steel. They're almost like slowly emulating Toyota and Hyundai Kia when it comes to the things that don't matter. So that's like door structure, body structure, suspension components. And when I looked at the EV architecture, particularly from the NIOs, well, I opened the hood and I'm looking and they had a fragmented architecture with disassociated high voltage componentry, box to box, thermal, you know, different boxes. What Tesla was doing in 2015 on the old Model S and X.
Right.
So they don't have any groundbreaking innovation when it comes to integration of high voltage components, thermal system breakthroughs. Now BYD with their battery and their battery lead, that is their big advantage. Their ability to manufacture and innovate in the battery space from chemistry perspective, volumetric and gravimetric. That's where they have the advantage. When it comes to the other core components of Chinese EVs, I don't see them having any advantage whatsoever compared to VW or GM. They're on par from my initial open the hood assessment. I'm like, nah, this is not impressive.
Right.
Well, on par to me would be a big, a big statement. You know, I'm curious if the manufacturing, you know, practices is on par or if it's still 8 years behind, like you had mentioned, with Tesla. That would be interesting to see.
Sandy and I bought a Chinese EV from the LA Auto Show. It's like the 30th ranked EV company in China. Barely shows up on list. The Skywell Imperium SEV. And it was at the auto show.
So they sold it to you.
No. Yeah. And we bought it for like 30 grand. And we put summer tires on it because it had weird Chinese tires. And we drive it around. It gets like 250 miles of range. It's comfortable. It's built for a Chinese person. The steering wheel is like smaller. It's like weird. There's a couple of weird peculiarities, but we also got the service manuals for it. So before we even tore it down, we were able to see every single part. And it's just like a basic car. All steel. Yeah, is that it? Oh, the ET5. Yeah, that's what we have.
Yeah.
We have it.
I love it. You bought this. That's amazing.
I bought it. It's literally sitting. We have a white one. Yeah, yeah. Keep going. It looks.
Look at that. It's sort of very basic Honda.
Looks like a Acura.
Designed by numbers.
That's what cheap, it looks like. Yeah. I mean, cheap that.
Wow.
And it's like 30th ranked. If you look at like where they're ranked, so
right.
low.
Right.
And this is pretty good. Like it's pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if that's nice, I'd like to hear what you think about the real top rated brands are, you know, quality wise. So put that on the list at some point.
We still have the MG. So we still have the MGs at S. We don't drive it. I need to sell that car. But like it is what it is. My wife loves it. And she doesn't care. I was watching a video yesterday from an Aussie YouTuber called HB Powerwall, Homebrew Powerwall. He makes Powerwalls out of 18650s. Right? And he bought a Ryobi $250 drill pack and the $70 from, you know, one of these Chinese websites. And he took them apart. And the Chinese one is dog awful inside. The bus bars are terrible. The nickel, the soldering, it's all of... But like, does my wife care what's underneath in the battery pack? As long as it's safe and my family is safe in that car, she just doesn't care. And it really fascinates me that, like, we're all car people. I say car guys, but we happen to be male. But, you know, everyone watching this channel is car guys or car girls. But my wife isn't. She wants reliable transport. And that car cost us 20 grand. It's been so reliable. Had a couple of warranty claims. MG, it's a 7-year warranty. MG, no questions asked, fixed that. And, like, I'd love to take it apart. But it works. It's fine. She's not a car person. So it's really interesting how many people are out there to buy cars like that who maybe aren't so much like us. And the Chinese cars just seem to tick so many boxes if they're at the right price. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. While we still have you here, I'd like to talk about something, just to drill down on a Tesla thing that Kyle did this week in one of his videos. So, Kyle has this out of spec detailing channel, and the guy who runs it, his name's Colton. His dad bought a Tesla Model 3 Performance this past week, mm-hmm. and so they did a video of the delivery experience. But then they brought it back to his shop and they put it under the highlights, and they did a walk around and look at the fit and finish and the paint quality throughout, and it was pretty interesting. So I want to know, so it's really good, actually. So they're saying, like, the Model 3, like, the panel's gaps were great. I think the hood was a little bit pinched on the very front of it a little bit, but other than that, and then the paint thickness was very consistent about, you know, around the whole thing, around 8 millimeters or 0.8 or whatever this thing is. So I was wondering, but so Kyle, just not so long aago, took delivery of a Tesla Model S Plaid, which is, like, a much more expensive vehicle. But the fit and finish isn't quite up to what they're doing with the Model 3. I don't know if you can talk about what's going on there with that.
Yeah, the higher the production, the easier it is to hone in the quality. So when we got our Model S Plaid, it was not that great. I remember when we took off the taillights, they had all sorts of secondary and tertiary applications of sealer and bond. The places you couldn't see, it was evident that they were struggling to get things sealed up. We had our rear window wouldn't even seal correctly. We had a trim fall out. The more bespoke the car, the more hand-built it is. So if you go think about a McLaren's, they get crap all the time. They're like nuts and bolts falling out because if you don't have the volume to invest in the tooling and processes to hone in the assembly process, you're relying on training of employees. And if you have an employee quit, now it's super complicated. So the bigger the machine, meaning the manufacturing plant, and the more robust the processes, and then the more you repeat those processes when you build a new plant. That's why Toyota, Ford, Honda, GM, they nail fit and finish quality. You don't even have to check. You buy a Lexus, it's perfect. It's just perfect. The paint's perfect because they have the checks and balances and the processes to hone that in. The Plaid or the Model S and the Model X, they don't build that many. And I think when the Model S Plaid came out, it was the first iteration of a huge change in the vehicle. Like the architecture changed quite a bit underneath with the, some of the body structure stuff. And
they look the same from the outside, but there's huge differences.
Oh, there's a lot of differences. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. So I guess my answer there is, the longer the company's been around and the more millions of vehicles they've developed and produced, the better they're going to be at refining that. And that's why you'll see Tesla finally refining Model Ys and Model 3s, because they've done all the hard learning and you try not to repeat your mistakes.
Right on. Well, I think we should probably let you go. Yep. And I would like to thank you very much for your time here. It's been great to hear, get your insight on some of these things. And to the audience, if you haven't watched Monroe Live, definitely subscribe to the channel. I was looking over some videos last night preparing it. I haven't had been budgeting very much YouTube time recently, just generally speaking. But I was looking at, I watched the Cadillac Lyric leather interior little video. So much information just about why all the stuff that's involved with changing like just a material thing like that. And it just gives you a lot of insight into, you know, manufacturing and production. It's very interesting. Anyway.
Awesome. I appreciate you having me on. I'll probably run into Kyle and Tom on the road this year. We're going to lots of different events. And nice to meet you, Martin and Dominic. Appreciate
it.
Nice to meet you. Coming on, Corey.
Bye.
All right. That was awesome. All right. So I don't even know what to do now. Okay.
Into the news, I guess.
No, I want to talk a little bit about your, because I'm not sure how long you can stay either, Kyle, because I believe you're in San Diego or headed to San Diego or something.
I'm in Phoenix right now on the way to San Diego.
Let Kyle talk first so he can jump off if he needs to.
Yeah. So you've had a pretty big, busy week this week, judging by your YouTube channel. So we just mentioned that one out of spec detailing, looking at the Model 3. That was great. I
haven't seen that video yet. So it's queued up. Oh, I'm looking forward to watching it.
Yeah, you should watch that. It's like the... is it 0.8 millimeters? Or do you think it would be the paint thickness reading?
I'm not sure if Colton's using microns, but it's very thin.
Right. Yeah. But it was very consistent all the way around, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, and like it doesn't really matter that much. It's cool.
It's good to know that they've got it, because I mean, Tesla's got a lot of criticism over time about their paint, you know?
Yeah. When I had my black Model 3 ceramic coated, the company almost didn't want to do it. And they called me up there and they showed me the measurements from different parts on the car. And they said, this is the thinnest paint we've ever measured on any car. They said, this is like a car came in here that's 15 years old and the paint has worn itself down. So they're like, if we damage something, you know, buffing it or whatever, we're not going to be responsible. I said, I'll just go ahead and do it. And in one spot, they actually did. There was slightly spot where I could see they wore the paint just enough where you could notice it, but it was, you know, it was a small area. And they pointed it out. They're like, see what we're talking about? We were so careful. They're like, this is a tragic that this is a new car. But anyway, go ahead, Kyle.
Yeah, we noticed the same with Lucid Air. But the thing to remember is Model 3 white paint is very different than their black paint process, because it's multiple layers, extra coatings. It's actually way harder to do that than my Model S black paint. So, I mean, I guess really the Model 3s are just awesome. A friend of mine just ordered a Model 3 Performance and like, they're just great. They're, you know, they're built well. They do everything you need. They're fast. They're priced very well. You can get white with white seats for $10 under the tax credit. It's just awesome. But I have to say, like, driving my Model S, which I just road tripped it from Colorado to Phoenix, that's one hell of a not well-built car. Also, just like... and it's, you know, of course, we had the incident where Jordan had pushed it into a curb. A lot of these things are from before it. I don't really think much is from the accident, but, you know, creaks and rattles like crazy in this Model S. I mean, it's so unbelievably loud. So I've scheduled some Tesla service stuff for it next week. Hopefully they can get all that taken care of. And someone crashed into it yesterday, backed into it at my hotel. And I was just like, oh no. So I think it's mostly just paint transfer, but you know, things you live with. It's funny, Max dinged down the side of the Model 3 this week. So we have white stripes. I don't know what actually happened, but so the Model 3 got damaged and then someone backed into the Model S. So always things that happen when you used cars, I guess. They're never going to repair themselves by driving, I guess.
No, I guess not. See, I just want to see any other videos you had. So you had a couple of other videos I want to just hit on real quick.
Before that, sorry to interrupt, but no. Colton just got a Nissan Ariya in the shop.
Oh,
and
really?
So he's going to, I think it goes up today, full in-depth tour of the Ariya build quality analysis, paint quality, fit and finish. And one of our viewers drove it out from Wisconsin to have Colton prep the car. I think he's owned it for almost a month. So pretty cool. It's one of the first Arias in America.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, so I'll definitely look up for that. I'm going to put that up on the forum too, I think, for the people interested in the Aria. Dave Kruger asks, just got here. Most important question yet. Does Dom have a car yet? Dom has a car, and I'll talk about that in a little bit if we have some time. But Kyle, you also had a video on the F-150 Lightning and the Rivian R1T in the snow. And I just wanted to know if just give us a quick rundown of how you thought they compared.
Oh, yeah. I mean, totally different trucks. So F-150 Lightning is a dual motor system. The Rivian's a four motor system, much smaller truck in the Rivian. And so you would think the Rivian would be the more fun, agile one to kind of hoon around. And in a sense, yes, I preferred the chassis in the Rivian. I think it's done really well for performance, fun driving. That was the point of this video. However, the Lightning actually won the comparison. It was more stable and had better driveline controls, better oversteering characteristics. Overall, I thought it was the better truck for this kind of stuff.
I'm so jealous. It's February 17th. It hasn't snowed in New Jersey yet. So like my whole point of this winter was I really wanted to do comparison between the two trucks and help me decide which one I'm going to keep. We haven't had any snow. And for the next 10 days, there's none in the forecast either. So like I might go through this winter and never have each vehicle touch the snow. We haven't done a complete winter here in northern New Jersey without at least an inch of snow since like the early 70s. So I'm so jealous watching Kyle spin around the course with the two vehicles. And I am sitting in my driveway here and it's, 40 degrees out.
Right. So Kyle, you also had a great video too, I think. And you did this like just facing the camera. I enjoyed just watching you just talking about the different cars, like 10. So you have 10 different cars that you recommend on a regular basis that people buy. So I don't know if you want to talk about this too much, but basically, you talk about the different cars for different types of buyers, different types of vehicles. But I noticed it was interesting. The VW ID.4 wasn't on that list. But maybe because it was the federal incentive situation, but you have recommended that car in the past to people.
Yeah, it was on. So I wasn't really thinking too much in, I don't know. I put this list together in 5 minutes. Right. ID.4 was a serious consideration. Sure. I left it off intentionally. It was number 11. Okay. And so I wanted to do 12. I couldn't think of a 12th. So
okay. Right.
I was like, oh, I'll just do 10.
Odd numbers work. Odd numbers good.
Yeah. I mean, I prefer not to do 10. Just it's like a YouTube algorithm thing. If you can do a different number than 5 or 10, the video should do a little bit better. ID4 is still really good. I mean, I do recommend that car a lot. I think what really, I was just a little bit annoyed that their lack of support from a software side on the car. Just bugs and weird little things. Like Michaela's car needs a whole rear, I think, motor inverter on a brand new Volkswagen ID.4. Really? Colton's car is fine though. And then Michaela's mom's car, was getting bought back and then getting a new one. And it's just like everyone I know with an ID.4 seems to have, it's a wonderful car at a great value. It drives really well, very high quality build on the fit and finish. It's the software controlling all of that stuff that just seems to be a bit annoying. And like if you factor in price, yeah, go ID.4 over Ioniq 5 or EV6 because you get the tax credit if it's a Chattanooga car and all of those things. But I still think in terms of electric cars, the EGMP stuff is far superior to Volkswagen's MEB platform at the moment.
Right. And again, I come back to that kind of car owner thing. When we had the ID.3, my wife loved it. And when I borrowed a friend's Model Y for a while to say, what do you think? Do you like this? She's like, this just feels like a £15,000. For her, Tesla is a budget. She knows it's not because she's married to me. For her, Tesla's a budget car because there's nothing in it. So it's just the big screen. And she loves her Kona because it's got the ultimate spec and it's got everything she wants. She loves the heated seats, the cooled seats, the sunroof, the all the toys that she loves. She doesn't give a damn about the app or the fact that it's better at energy management or more efficient on a long journey or any of those or charging. I mean, very quickly, I've been doing some long road trips recently to see a family member, and I stopped on the way, and I don't normally use it, but I stopped at a Tesla supercharge that was open to third parties. And the damn thing started charging immediately and took the Kona up to about 83 kilowatts. And it's like, I thought that thing could charge at 77. I've never had a third party. I've never had a third party charge that fast and up to about 75%. So what on earth the Tesla supercharger and the car were doing, they were like having this massive love fest. It charged fast, you know, for a Kona, fast and really high in the pack. Just a reminder, Tesla's brilliant. And for my wife, she's like, well, I'm not owning one of those, because that's just a complete, I'm not spending 60 grand on a budget car. So that's again, for her, I didn't like the ID3. Because you know, ID4, I know we're comparing the software the same, but she loved it. It was friendly and airy and bright, and she didn't care that the software wasn't great. So it's really interesting looking at those different types of buyers. I'm right with you on the ID4. The software frustrates the heck out of me, but I wonder how many people are bothered by that, or people like us.
See, I'm not. I actually like the software on ID4. The user interface and all that stuff works well for me. I understand a lot of people have issues. I'm not discounting that. Mm. I like all the interaction touch points. The only thing that bothers me are the door windows that they don't have four switches for. But that's a hardware issue rather than a software thing. So, yeah. But didn't recommend the ID4. I think maybe what I could have done was combine the EGMP cars into one category. IONIQ 5, EV6, GV60, doesn't really matter. Take your pick. You know, it's all the same thing underneath. And then, you know, ID4 could have been one of those. I thought about that. I don't know. Maybe in the next top 10 you should buy, I'll do something like that. It's not, you know, super serious of a video. It's just my thoughts on some cars for sale. Yeah,
that was great. I enjoyed watching it. And just a quick technical question. Was that your just the iPhone camera that you shot that with?
Well, yep, just the selfie. Everything's on iPhone. So this was just the front camera on my iPhone. Not even the back camera.
Maybe it's the lighting there. It's just like, looks really nice. Anyway, so something else I should have really touched on this one first. You made a video about one of the topics that I thought we should touch on today, and that is that we learned more details about the opening of the Tesla Supercharger network to non-Tesla vehicles and how that's going to work. So we've known this has been in the works for a while. But now Elon Musk has gone to Washington, and now we're getting some details. And the White House released a whole bunch of information about, you know, not only the Tesla involvement in supercharging, but also like seeing some EVgo and GM and a few other networks that are popping up. But in this case, so Tesla will open 7,500 supercharger and destination chargers to CCS vehicles by the end of 2024, so end of next year. 3,500 of those will be 250 kilowatt stations along highway corridors. Additionally, Tesla will more than double its full network of superchargers. So it looks like there will be a good number of Tesla-only chargers. So let's see if you agree with me here, Kyle, that I'm picturing this right, what's going to happen. Over the next couple of years, Tesla will double the number of pedestals in the supercharger network, but at the same time, it will open up 3,500 to CCS cars. So it sounds like Tesla drivers might not be as impacted by this as we were afraid.
I mean, I don't think I was afraid. I was hoping that everything would be a CCS port on it. I'm a fan of you either don't do it or you go all in. I don't like this whole half approach, to be totally transparent. Yeah. Sure. I think it confuses people. You know, if you were able to charge a Tesla supercharger in the last stop, but now you got to go find an EA and the supercharger, sorry, that one's a busy one. You can't go there. It makes sense as a Tesla owner. There's still a competitive advantage to buying a Tesla over other vehicles, especially as this rollout, I think, is going to happen slowly. But I think they have a real opportunity to open up new corridors. For example, I was driving from Albuquerque down southern New Mexico and then over just to avoid Flagstaff for snow. And I looked on PlugShare and you could not take a CCS vehicle on that route, at least not reliably. Right. And so it's like there's four superchargers on a road where there's no CCS infrastructure. Those could easily be opened up, a new route, very low travel. We didn't really see any other Teslas there. could have been very easy to do. So many opportunities for them to open. I think the Magic Dock situation with the built-in adapter to the Chargers, genius. I can't wait to see how that works. Yeah, just really excited for this, to be honest. But I think Tesla owners won't be impacted very much, at least at first. But I made a video, you know, the video I made about it basically says, like, you're going to get some weird looks, as Martin has talked about occasionally, if you're in your Bolt, you know, charging up at a Tesla supercharger.
Yeah, and please, I would say, please be respectful of each other. So the station that I used in somewhere called Thetford in East Anglia, it's got 8 bays at the moment. It's about to become 16. It's been like that for 6 months or so. So maybe it's permitting or power issues. But either way, they've still got their little covers, their little jackets on the other 8. But the end one, there's 8 are equally divided. 7 are equally divided. And the 8th one is just offset a little bit. And because of where the charge port is on the Kona and how short the cables are on a supercharger, if I'm going to use one of the others, it's going to effectively block 2 spaces for a Tesla owner, which, I mean, is fine if I want to be that person. But the 8th one was free. I'm able to park at a bit of an angle. It doesn't disrupt the Tesla way of doing things. And look, I was the only person there. So it was like 5 o'clock on a Sunday morning. But otherwise, if everyone's respectful to each other in the US, we've had this for, you know, over a year now in Europe, then it all works fine. And there's no need to shout at each other or get frustrated. But if you are a CCS or non-Tesla, if you'd want to put it that way, owner, please be respectful of what you're using. And equally, yeah, I mean, it's weird if you've bought a Tesla because you like being part of the club. I don't like all that, but there are plenty of people, I don't mean to offend you, there are plenty of people that wear that as a badge of honor. You know, they're in the club, and to have a Bolt turning up is going to be weird, but it's happening.
I get what you're saying, Martin, about be respectful, but you pull, you know, you're on a road trip with your Bolt, and you know, you've mapped it out, and now the supercharger's open, and you know, you this is the station, the only station you're going to stop in, and you've got to block 2 spots with your Bolt, and you're going to be there for an hour and a half because that's how long it's going to take you to get to your next you know, your the next charger or your destination. What's respectful? Unplug, yeah, and leave if a Tesla shows up, and
let you have to charge
and first. You know, it's going to be difficult in some situations.
And that's what I've said to people when I've been a bit more bloody-minded on social media, when they're like, I can't believe they're abusing a Tesla station. And I said, it's no longer a Tesla station. It's now open. Right. So it's now, it might have the logo on, but it's the same as having an Ionity logo. You know, just because I'm not driving a VW group car or any of the investors in that, you can't use Ionity. Like, it might have the Tesla logo, but it's an anyone station now. And that is a mindset for Tesla owners to get their head around. And I know that many people don't agree with me on that. And ultimately, Elon Musk could wake up and change his mind and you know, it all goes away. So I'm being slightly flippant. They are Tesla stations, but the minute they're open, as Tom said, Tesla owners are going to have a little shock to the system at times.
It would be very helpful if Tesla would redesign the superchargers that have CCS, the Magic Dock on it, to have longer cables, which, you know, make the unit taller and have a longer cable. So then it could reach the, you know, either side of a vehicle if the vehicle's charge port is in a, you know, less desirable location. I know that would still going to be different. Some vehicles still wouldn't line up. But, you know, if it had an extra 3 or 4 feet of cable, it might allow some of the vehicles at least to occupy the space that the charger was meant for.
Right. So we should, I don't know, how long, much more longer do you think you have, Kyle?
Oh, I'm going to bolt now, but I just wanted to say I spent the day at Atlas in Phoenix.
Right.
And we did some really, really cool stuff. So that's going to all launch sometime next week. Right. We can share some of those videos, but yep, really cool stuff. If you want the teaser, go to my Twitter. I actually can't even say anything about it. I can just post that photo. So it was insane. I think you can gather from that post. It's just the craziest thing ever. Yes.
I mean, I've seen you sponsor a couple of videos on your channel. I've seen you just mention them. So I Googled them and they do like I'm not even sure what it, I just submitted a couple of minutes on it and it was like last night, early in the morning.
Yeah, we'll talk about it next week more in depth. But if you just want to see the cool thing, go to my Twitter. Okay. It's a few posts down.
And it's Kyle Connor.
a big number is what you'll see.
Okay. All right. So happy trails. Drive Thank safe.
You. And I'm head in the car and go to San Diego. See you on another one. See you guys right. later.
Later, Kyle.
See you. Bye. Okay. Okay, so
I don't mean to hate on the news, given that Inside EVs is a news website, but I want to know what Tom has been up to, and I want to know, Dom, about your car, and we've got 13 minutes. So
right.
I fear the running order took a kicking today.
We're all over the place. So yeah.
I want to hear about what you guys have done this week.
All right, let me go first, and I'll rattle through quickly, and then we'll let Dom end the show talking about his cars. Okay, so the funny thing is that Kyle said he's got a Bolt. I got a Bolt too.
That's right.
Wow, look at this. Look at this.
So I waited for, I'll put it up here. It's a purchase order for a Bolt EV1 LT. I waited for Dom to make his decision on what car he was going to get. And when he decided he didn't want to get a Bolt, I said, well, we have to get a Bolt for the Inside EVs podcast. So I went out and ordered one. Going to take me a few months to get it, but I got a base 1LT stripped, except with the I forget exactly what they call it. It's a package with the lane assist and the rear cross traffic. It was $395. So all in, it was like $27,990. And I'm not going to be able to take possession before March 1st because I have to order it. And these things take months to come in. So there's no guarantee I'll get the full $7,500 federal tax credit. We don't know what the Bolt is going to qualify for once they announce the battery mineral sourcing. I've talked to some people at GM, and they appear confident that it's going to qualify for the full $7,500. I don't, you know, let's see. It should for sure qualify for at least half. And in New Jersey, we have a $4,000 cash on the hood at the purchase charge up program rebate. However, that program runs out of money every year, and it's going to run out of money in about 2 months. So they estimated my Bolt will not be in for at least 3 months. So I may end up, when it comes in, you know, only qualifying for a half of the federal tax credit and no cash on the hood for New Jersey. If that's the case, I'll rethink about it. I might push it back. I might tell the dealership to hold it for a month or so, until the New Jersey program gets refunded in like August or something like that. But in any event, so I have a iced blue Bolt on order, and I'm looking forward to getting that. That'll be the vehicle that we drive around here when I sell one of the pickup trucks, probably spring, summerish time, or whenever, when not too long, probably after the Bolt comes in. So that's what I've been up to as far as buying cars. And did a couple of posts on Inside EVs. I reviewed the I forget the name of it now. The
Evo Charge
because I did another charger review after that I haven't posted yet.
Okay.
I reviewed the Evo Charge EV charger. It comes in a 32 amp unit and a 40 amp unit, smart and non-smart, with 18 foot and 25 foot cables. They kind of let you order it any way you want it, which is pretty. I like when they give the people options on smart or non-smart, how long of a cable do you need, and so forth. It did pretty well. It scored pretty well. It's a good solid unit. Had some shortcomings. That the cable really did poorly in the cable deep freeze test, as many of the cables do, but not all of them. So it's an important test to do. It passed most of the other tests. The connector isn't that good. The interesting thing is they use a different connector for the 32 amp unit and for the 40 amp unit. The 40 amp unit has a much better, more robust connector, and the connector on the 32 amp unit broke when I dropped it. It passed when I did. You did it on the 40 amp unit. It didn't break to make it non-usable. It did crack the outer plastic. So if that was my charger, I'd put some crazy glue in it to make sure it didn't get worse. Thanks, Adam. And, it's a pretty solid unit. I like what EvoCharge is doing. It's a U.S.-based company. This unit is manufactured in Taiwan. But from what I understand, talking to the company, they're going to shift production to the U.S. at some point and make them here. It's a really small, compact unit, which I really like. I don't think there's any need to have these giant things hanging up on your wall. And it's a nice unit. It comes with a good app. You know, it's one of my recommended units now. And I don't know if I'd go as far as saying it's my, you know, top five, but, you know, for those people that bought this unit, you know, you didn't get a bad unit. They're one of the my major gripes is it should have a better connector. It should have a better cable, and they need to offer it in a 48 amp option, which they currently don't. So, but other than that, I think it's a good solid unit. And the company makes these really cool cable retraction units, retractors, two different versions of it. I'm going to do a separate review of those where you can install them on the wall in your garage, and it's a spring loaded reel that you can use it to manage your cable, which, you know, I get some people asking me for that and say, Tom, I'd love to have some type of cable retraction units, or the cable's not draped on the floor. So we'll have a review on that probably in, maybe a month or so. So that's it for the Evo Charge. Good solid unit. I wouldn't tell somebody not to get one. What else, Tom? What else you have on my list?
That's it.
Oh, no, the Ford. Ford's,
oh, yeah, you're right.
Because
right.
I wrote that article. This is an important one. We need to hit on this.
Yes.
Ford announced a $3.5 billion investment in their Blue Oval Battery Park in Marshall, Michigan. They're going to manufacture LFP batteries there. That's a picture of the LFP cells. You notice they're prismatic cells. That's a departure from the pouch cells that they currently use for the NCM cells that they use in their EVs currently. So what they're going to do is they're going to continue making pouch cells with the nickel, cobalt, manganese chemistry, but they're going to be making prismatic cells for LFP because they can get more energy, they can get more battery inside each individual cell, which you need to with the LFPs because they're not as energy dense as right. NCM is. That's, you know, the negative parts with for LFPs are they're not as energy dense. They don't perform as well in cold weather, but they are less expensive. There's better availability of the products used to make them, and there's no human rights or environmental issues as there are with cobalt and nickel. And the LFP batteries have a longer life, and you can charge them to 100% on a daily basis, and it doesn't they don't degrade as quickly as they would if you did that with NCM. So you can actually have greater range if Ford's able to, and they are able to. We noticed. I was there with Seth from Electrek, and he actually is the one that pointed it out. He looked at the stamping on the side of Ford had a Mustang Mach-E battery pack, standard range pack there, and it was 78 kilowatt hour total capacity. So it's possible that the new Mach-Es, the way Ford's going to do it is the Mach-Es are going to have come standard. The standard range packs will have LFP. The right. extended range packs will be NCM. And then starting next year, that's what's going to happen with the Lightning. The Lightning standard range battery are going to be using LFP, extended range, the NCM. And so the standard range packs might actually have greater range than what the existing standard range packs has, because they're going to have the same total capacity, but Ford will be able to use more of that capacity. And they'll tell you to charge. You can charge to 100%, which they currently say 80-85%. You should be charging daily for the Lightning and the Mach-E. So there's definite advantages to that. The disadvantages is they don't have as good of cold weather performance, but Ford is working to try to, improve their thermal management systems, make mm-hmm. them more efficient so that they don't have as big a compromise in when the packs are very cold. Now, it's important
I believe
to note
they
that.
Want to be charged to 100%. I think in terms
yeah.
of the
yeah, they recommend
the,
it. Yeah.
BMS they calibration. I think that's when the Tesla first had the LFP cells over here. I'd got some listeners to the podcast in Austria and Switzerland, and cold weather compared to me anyway. And they were having awful problems in the first 2 or 3 weeks of the car just charging at 2 or 3 kilowatts when it was cold and down low. The cars wouldn't charge. The BMS calibration was all over the place. And Tesla got on top of that really quickly with software updates. But with the LFP cells, I'm no battery expert, but I believe the calibration is done more on to do with the pack voltage. And therefore they like to be charged to 100% regularly. And then you get more range, as Tom says. So
which makes it easy for people.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's great. And it's, let's say, cheaper and less concerns over what's in them, and it makes perfect sense. So.
Yeah, and it's good to have an alternative material, you know, battery material thing, because there's just not enough, you know, the volume of nickel and other materials that are being mined for our traditional NMC batteries. It's just like, this is a whole other, you know, source of materials. Anybody,
and also the right tool for the job. Like my home battery has NMC cells, which is crazy. And that partly the reason why it's in the garage as well, not under the stairs, where I was originally going to put it inside there. I'm not for a minute saying that I don't think the SolarEdge stuff is 1,000% safe. It's got a fire extinguisher in it. It's fine. But it's a home battery. I'm not pulling any more than 5 kilowatts. 5 kilowatts is the peak I can pull from it. Why are they not LFP cells? And why are they cells that, you know, chemically are more unstable? But again, not saying for a minute I think that battery is unsafe, but I was like, nah, you can stick that in the garage. There's like, why isn't that LFP? It's a home battery. So the right tool for the right job, and lots of people are not going to be able to go 0 to 60 in 2.5 seconds with these, but that's fine, honestly.
It is the right tool for the right job. You know, a lot of the standard range packs, say on the Lightning, are for the commercial end, and you know, these are durable batteries that last. They last longer, there's less chance of thermal runaway. They're inherently safer. There's a lot of reasons why we'll do this, and you know, Ford just needs more battery cells. You know, they don't they can't produce everything enough NCM. And Ford is the first manufacturer now to announce that they'll be making both NCM and LFP in factories in the U.S. So that's a good agreement. Now this is, they have an agreement with Cadel. Cadel is going, they're licensing Cadel's technology. They make the best LFP cells today. And but this is a Ford plant. It's wholly owned by Ford. Ford reiterated many times, we do not have a partnership with Cadel. Like this is a Ford plant with Ford employees. We're licensing their technology, and immediately, they're going to be buying LFP cells today from Cadel until the factory is up and running, because the Mach-E standard range is going to be coming with LFP cells soon. I think as early as next month. You won't be able to get it with the NCM. And then the Lightning next year in the spring of 2024, all the standard range packs will be LFP. So they're going to be imported from China until this factory is up and running. Which is going to take a couple of years. I mean, they're just starting to build it now. So, you know, but they're going in that direction. I think it's a good move.
Yeah. It's turned into a bit of a political football, though. You know, like Virginia took itself out of the running for it. And then now Senator Marco Rubio is like,
it seems, Dom, that their big axe is saying, well, they're licensing Chinese technology. Well, right now we kind of have to. We're behind in this technology. Ford and U.S. companies don't have as good of LFP tech as Cadel does. So, you know, in the short term, the right play is to license their technology. I'm sure Ford is planning on having their own tech and LFP batteries that they'll be making at this plant in a few years. I mean, they didn't tell us that. I don't have any inside information, but you know, I would imagine that this is just a temporary thing to license the tech, to get the factory making it there, and then eventually have their own, you know, battery tech that they'll be making. I mean, that would make sense, but this is the right play to do now. It's better, even if it's Cadel tech, it's better to be making it in Michigan and employing, you know, 2,500 people than constantly shipping the stuff over from China.
Right, I agree. That's I'm kind of shocked. There's like,
you're shocked against that politicians took something and made it political.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess, but you know, the turning down like, you know, thousands of jobs and investment in your state is like, it's like that's kind of crazy. But you know, that wouldn't fly like 20, 30 years ago, but it does today, I guess. Anyway. What else do we want to talk about today? We're just about
your car.
Time.
You, that's it. You, that's it.
Your car.
So, okay. So I got, there it is. So if you're watching this, if you're not watching this on YouTube or Twitch, we're looking at a picture of this black on black Tesla Model 3 long range car. So I went up to, after the show last week, I flew up to Chicago and stayed overnight. So I got to the dealership nice and early in the morning and picked this up. And man, this, I got to see it in person, and you never know what you're getting. You know, you buy over the internet and you get pictures, but you can't, the picture's not all the details that you want to see. So man, when I got there and could see it in real life, it was like such a relief. I mean, there's no dents or dings, or I think if there's any scratching, it's like super light. Three of the rims have rim rash, but that's cool. It's on the support wheels, as you can see, like 19 inch. Thank you, Adam. You've been very nice, Adam. Thank you. Let's see what else. So yeah, I got there, and the handover, the whole, you know, the whole transaction thing, it was so much, it was great. It was, you know, my salesperson was great. It was at Victor Ford, if anyone's, you know, in Wakanda, Illinois. And yeah, sales guy was great. They don't get a lot of electric vehicles in there yet, but they did actually, they had a Ford F-150 Lightning in there that they bought a base, and then an upfitter came in and put a whole package on it. And it looked incredible. And just like the interior, actually, they redid this, all this, the leather seats and all that. It was all done color coded. It's a red and white theme. And actually, so I've started a new YouTube channel, and I'm going to put up a YouTube or a video of the trip back. So I drove back over 2 days. I didn't put just like 1,000 miles, and going down a north to south corridor. I went a little bit west of, I wanted to go around Chicago, and it ended up going through like the barrens of Illinois. I had no idea. I was in Illinois for like over a day of driving. It's a huge state, like from north to south. And I was started at the very top of it and down to the very bottom. So I ended up going like this little country roads, and it was awesome. So much better than like getting stuck on the interstate for, you know, hundreds of miles. And there was like no traffic, and it's like straight. And a lot of the roads are super, super smooth. You could kind of open it up. I didn't hit I guess the top speed is 140. It hasn't seen that.
but you had fun.
It was an enjoyable ride coming back. So no squeaks and rattles. It's got full FSD, full self-driving, which I haven't activated that yet, but I did use the TACC, traffic aware cruise control. So on the highway, when you're driving, it's on cruise control, I want to pass, I just hit the turn stalk, and it does that. I look too, just because I want to be sure. And you don't have to reactivate autopilot all the time. It's just like nice and smooth. It also has the premium interior, which I didn't know. So it's got like the lumbar supports and nice seats on the driver and passenger side. I believe they deleted the passenger lumbar supports more recently, so you can't even get that anymore. And it's just, yeah, the seats were great. It was a great driving car. I was surprised that actually it's rear wheel drive. It doesn't have, after driving Kyle's performance, I was kind of spoiled by the takeoff and everything. But this, just the rear-wheel drive with the it's a long-range battery, so it's got. I'm not sure the 0 to 60. I think it might be around 5.1 seconds. Does that sound right to you, Tom?
0 to 60 in 5.1. Oh, it's
quicker than that.
It's faster than that. It's in the fours.
Yeah,
is it?
At least,
okay, because it feels pretty quick. I gotta say,
yeah, it's in the fours.
It's got Michelin Pilot Sport tires on it with lots of tread. That was another thing. I was like, am I going to get up there and it's going to have like four different tires or whatever on it? But the person who owned it before me, took really good care of it. And so after I got back, I looked at the supercharging, just the details and the, you know, you can get right deep into the menus. Larry R says, Dom, black those wheels out now. Yeah. Yeah. Is that a thing? I need to do some Googling and see what it looks like on black wheels. Cause maybe, yeah, I don't know. What was I just saying? I get so excited.
I was looking at the comments, but yeah. David says 5.1 for long range. That seems really, is that right? Okay. Maybe it is. If he's looked up the specs, I thought it was in the fours, but yeah.
I thought it was in the high fours, but honestly, I haven't looked at it in a while, and I've driven them. It feels like it's in the high fours.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm really surprised. I haven't really driven it hard, like, you know, in a dynamic situation, but hopefully that'll be happening soon. I want to go a little road trip and make some more videos. So yeah, that Ford F-150 Lightning that I was talking about, I made a video of that, so I can share that. So cool. I'll hopefully have that kind of stuff up there too. The channel is called Drive Electric with Dominic. Pretty simple, pretty self-explanatory. And yeah, that's about it. Right.
Wow. Well, it's no Bolt, so right. Huge congratulations.
I enjoy driving the Bolt, and it was very comfortable. I had the totally specced out one when I had it, so maybe it's a little bit nicer than the one Tom will see. But I don't know, I'm kind of curious about the cloth seats, but you definitely, it's just whisper quiet, except for the rear motor, you can actually hear it whine sometimes. Yeah.
You can't go wrong with a Model 3. I mean, I've owned two of them, Dom, and they're great cars. You know, you did well with this for sure.
I'm pretty happy with. So, David, let's remind me, Dom, you mentioned checking supercharger details, right? So that was the thing. After the trip, I checked. So in the past month, this thing has been supercharged. I'm the only one that supercharged it. 204 kilowatt hours, 386 kilowatt hours. $132. But I looked at so you can go back and look at the supercharging history over the past year. It was never supercharged in the past.
Wow. No way. It's always been AC charged, and it's just been cared for the battery. Oh, you found a beaut. Absolute beaut. I mean, you look for a long time. It's a real needle in a haystack with your car search. You didn't just, impulse buy. Right. We're so happy for you. I really hope you found something that is reliable, puts so many smiles on your face, and it's a great car.
It does put a smile on your face. It's like, it's just, as you pull out of the driveway and hit that thing, it's just nice. But I'm pretty happy with it, actually. Now I got to figure out how to pay for it. That's all.
So tell us about that. Well, the YouTube channel will do that. So what's it called again?
Drive Electric with Dominic.
I'm sorry I didn't have that ready. I should have that ready.
No, it's all right. I mean, there's nothing there yet. I need to. I've got a few ideas of what I have to do with the logos and all that kind of stuff. But I think I'm just going to start making. I got to get a video up there fast. So hopefully this weekend, we'll have the first video up there, and then we'll just put some up, and then we'll make it fancier later or something. Mm. Anyone have any questions? We're kind of over time, so maybe. We should call it a day. What do y'all think?
Dave says the spark is forgotten. No, the spark will always have a place. No, in Dom's heart.
I love the spark. It still has a piece in my heart. All right. So I guess that brings us to the end of our show. If you have any questions or comments, you can leave them on the Inside EVs Forum podcast thread or on our YouTube or Twitch comment sections. If you like the show, please give us a thumbs up if you're watching us on YouTube. Don't forget, you can find and follow our panelists on Twitter. Follow Tom Malogny at Tomalog, that's with two M's. Martin Lee is at EV News Daily. Kyle Connor is at It's Kyle Connor. Corey Steuben, our guest from earlier, he's also on Twitter. I don't have his handle down here because, I'm new at this.
You look him up.
I know you can find
just,
him really
just
quick.
Just search his name.
Can just search Corey Steuben and he'll pop up. And follow him on Twitter and Monero Live, of course, because it's, really great. Man, it's such a great YouTube channel. There's so much good information that nobody else gives you out there. It's just extraordinary.
That's great to have a guest for show 150, wasn't it, today? 150?
Yes, 150, yeah. And yeah,
well, in the I bag. Think we'll, what a great way
I
to celebrate.
We'll try to get another guest in a few weeks here, I think. So click subscribe, tap that bell icon for notifications, and we'll see you all again next week. Thanks for joining us. Ciao.